Welcome to the Rand CRE Show. Commercial real estate with no stone left unturned.
What's up, everyone? This is Dylan Marma bringing to you the Rand CRE Show, joined by my co-host, Mike Taravella. How are you doing today, Mike?
You know, just living the dream, making it happen, and excited to give our viewers our guest today for the podcast.
Very excited about today's episode. We oftentimes are presenting information for both active and passive investors, and I really believe that today's show is going to be a very special episode for the passive investors. Whether you're a new passive investor or you're an experienced LP that's been part of many deals, you're going to learn a whole lot of information. And just real quick before we get started, we always want to remind you the Rand CRE Show is hosted by Rand Commercial Real Estate, a vertically integrated real estate investment and advisory firm, providing opportunities for investors to create passive streams through investing in real estate, as well as providing active investors with the ability to source debt and equity across the board. So if you have any questions about how to fund your next deal, or if you are interested in partnering with us through investing passively, you can always reach us at randcre.com.
And our guest today is Travis Watts, who's a full-time passive investor. He's been doing real estate since 2009 from multifamily, single family, and vacation rentals. He is also the director of investor relations at Ashcroft Capital and has been a part of over 25 syndications between 14 different firms. So Travis, welcome to the show. How's it going?
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Happy New Year by the, when this gets released.
Yeah.
We're right in the middle of it, right? Right. Kind of coming off of Christmas and onto New Year's now. But what a better way to, what better time to have this show than a time when everyone's thinking about setting goals for the upcoming new year. And for many people, I know a large part of setting goals is setting your financial goals, setting your investment goals. So I think Travis shares a very unique story. Yet at the same time, I think probably many people listening to the show that have been in real estate can resonate with the story. You know, he coming off the background of being very active in real estate and starting in the single family space, getting into multifamily. He's had some major takeaways, it sounds like, and that have made a dramatic impact and really changed the direction of his overall investment strategy. So Travis, I know we've heard from you, but we'd love to hear for our audience. You want to share with us a little bit on what is your story and how did you get your start to become a full-time passive investor?
Sure, Dylan. Yeah. So like you said, I got started probably in a way that most people get started in real estate. Back in 2009 and the few years before, if you would have said real estate investor, I wouldn't have thought of anything but single family homes and investing in my own backyard. That's all I knew. And you know, those in my family, like my dad and my stepmom have got some single family rentals. And that was my entire world in scope of thinking about this. So I knew I always wanted to be in real estate. I didn't know how, I didn't know when. And long story short, what I had done is I had been working since age 15. I had saved up as much as I could. And I had a little bit of money my parents had saved for college. And I ended up not using any of it because I knew I wanted to do something else with that and not blow that on tuition. Just for me personally. So I took that little lump sum in 2009 and, you know, the stars aligned, right? We had a meltdown, which was a terrible thing for so many people, including, you know, all of my family and specific to those in stocks and some in real estate. Long story short, that's when I got started. So I actually got started with a single family home. Just one. It was a two bed, one bath. And I bought it for myself to live in because that particular year, the IRS or the government was giving out the $8,000 tax credit for first time home buyers. And more specifically, the one that you could actually keep. Years leading up to that, they gave it out and then you had to pay it back. It was a weird deal. And so I really benefited from that. Got a roommate later on, realized that passive income was just about paying my entire mortgage. And so, you know, hence the house hacking start. And then I ended up getting a high paying job in the oil industry where I was working 100-hour work weeks away from home. It was terrible work. I really didn't fit in. I was just doing it for the paycheck, quite honestly. Mm-hmm. And I was putting it all away into real estate. I was saving, then investing, saving, investing. And so I got more into the fix and flips. And then that led to vacation rentals. And so my point being, I was doing all this active real estate without having a clear defined goal, just knowing that one day I wanted to be passive and didn't know how. And as I started to acquire these properties, and especially as I started going way more active with vacation rentals, I just realized this is a job. You know, all I'm doing is building a job, and every property I get's that much more work. Tried property management and, you know, some variable things like that, still was a lot to manage. I mean, you're not only thinking about managing tenants per se, but I'm managing, you know, the asset managers and some of the tenants still, and, you know, having to do all my bookkeeping and having to save all my receipts. And, you know, the whole thing just became way too active for me on top of that job that I had, which is the W-2 oil field gig. And it was about the time I went overseas. I started working in the Middle East with the oil company. I was away from home 37 days at a time. And it was at that point that I pulled the plug and said, you know, I can't do this. I can't scale this portfolio up, you know, any larger than it is today. And that was nowhere near where I wanted to be long-term. So about 2015 or so, I found syndications to be completely passive, to be a limited partner in some larger deals, and to be literally passive with my investing approach. I was a bit skeptical. It was new to me. You know, I'd listened to podcasts. I'd talked to people. I'd joined some real estate meetups, and I kept hearing the word syndication. And so I tried one. And, you know, and I sat back about 6 months. I watched it unfold. I watched the monthly distributions come in, the monthly reporting. And I finally just dedicated to that strategy and that philosophy in real estate. Love the asset class. Just didn't really want to be in the middle of the business personally. I had other things I was working on, which tends to be the story for a lot of people that do syndication investing, right? You have an income, you want to invest, but you don't necessarily want to be, you know, boots on the ground per se. So ever since then, like you said, 25 plus, actually it's probably 26, right. 27 now. And yeah, a lot of syndications as a limited partner.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's amazing.
Well, that is a lot of investments that I can't wait to dive into what your investing strategy is as you're investing passively and so on. But even before that, I want to touch on a point you made in your story. For you, you were in a very, it seemed like you were in a good paying role, you said, in the oil industry, right? And very demanding, a lot of hours. And you came to the epiphany very quickly that you were creating a second job as you were out there investing in real estate. And I say it that way because what we do on a day-to-day basis, I like to consider being a real estate entrepreneur, right? When we say real estate investor or stock investor, you think of it, you picture it as putting some money away and watching it grow and having this nice nest egg down the road.
Being on the beach.
Right. But it's similar to maybe in the stock market being a day trader, right? They're not really a day investor. They're a day trader. They're actively trading, actively watching the market. And it's no different for guys that are sponsoring real estate deals. You're being a real estate entrepreneur, having to think outside the box, having to actively market for deals, having to actively asset manage and things like that. And really the ones that are true, what I'd consider true investors, are the ones that are investing as a limited partner, because you're making a strategic investment decision to create a passive stream of income. So I think it's a great takeaway. And it's probably one of those lessons that you wish you had learned earlier on, right?
It definitely is, although with the caveat that it does take a bit of capital to make passive investing make sense, right? So had I, day one in 2009, someone said, why don't you do a syndication? I don't think I would have put, you know, 20,000 into a syndication and then, you know, been broke at that point.
Totally.
It just wouldn't have motivated me enough to keep on that path.
You have to be in a good financial position to actually get on the investing side, right? For most people, starting off as the real estate entrepreneur is probably the best route, unless they have a very good position that they're going to work and save in, and then transition into more of the investing side.
Sure. Yeah.
Plus you build your fundamentals and you beat your head against the same wall of, all right, having to do the same thing over and over again, where you realize you're building systems, you're building processes, and you realize I'm working 100 plus hours at a W-2 job and I have more responsibilities as soon as I leave. So it's building the machine financially and just as a business, as an entrepreneur, like you said, Dylan.
Mm-hmm. Completely. Yep. 100%.
So let's talk about that first deal that you invested in passively. What was that experience like? You mentioned you maybe were a little bit skeptical at the time, unsure of things. What were some of the questions you were asking yourself, the fears you had to overcome, and how did it go?
Yeah, I think I knew just enough to get started, but I didn't know nearly enough. Not that it takes that much, but I was just new. So you don't know what you don't know. So the first group I had invested with was a local group, because I thought that would be important, just to have someone I could go see face to face and meet with. And, you know, I know where they live. And so I realized over time that really didn't matter at all. You know, it just didn't. I mean, I always advise that you try to meet with the groups that you invest with, if possible, face to face, maybe at an event or a networking opportunity. If that's not possible because you live in California, they're in New York, whatever it may be, try to get on a call like this, like a Zoom call or something. You know, just try to, you know, get the gut check and get your questions answered, and, you know, speak directly to you know, the sponsors, if possible. So the mistake that I always reference, that, well, I call it a mistake, the learning curve here, was that I was focused way too heavily on a pro forma in the beginning. I was way too heavily focused on just numbers and saying, well, this deal over here is 8% and this deal over here is 10%. I'm just going to do the 10%, right? That makes sense. Mm-hmm. That's going to pay more. Well, without considering who's behind the scenes, who's on the team, what's their track record, what's their history, you know, stuff like that. So, so yeah, long story short, I mean, so far, you know, knock on wood, you know, all the deals have come through as being profitable, although a lot of the business plans from some of the more, amateur groups, if you will, didn't really get executed as planned. So that's been my experience so far.
Yeah, I think it's important when you realize those pro formas is that they always make money, and it's what happens day one upon takeover. So it's really making sure you ask the questions and vetting what happens if this happens. How much flexibility does the business plan change? So it's really making sure you trust the group that you vet, right, and sponsor, and go through and execute.
And it's knowing the group, and it's also understanding what the risk is, right? I think that's the challenge that a lot of investors have starting off. I think that's a great example you shared, because I think a lot of people right now are chasing IRR, and a 15 IRR on one deal can be very different than a 15 IRR on another deal. If you look at, go on online, you can look at CrowdStreet and Real Crowd and a lot of these online places where you can actually shop for deals that are publicly marketed, and you'll see very clearly that hotel deals demand a higher IRR, that the development deals are demanding a higher IRR, right? That the yield on different deals, on retail deals is going to be much higher. And there's reasons behind all this, because there's various levels of risk built in. So usually when you see a higher return, there's usually some higher degree of risk built into the picture. So do you want to touch on that at all, Travis? How do you determine what the risks are and what should be the objects that investors should be looking for to determine the risk of an investment?
Yeah, like you said, everybody's criteria is going to be different, right? What I may perceive as a risk may not be the same as what you perceive as a risk. There's things I certainly care a lot about that maybe you don't care about. So the point is exactly what you said. Ask your questions to the sponsor. If you're worried about a recession, ask about a recession. What's going to happen potentially if that were to happen? What's that going to look like? You know, as an example, someone else may think, well, there's no recession in sight. You know, the Fed says that we're all good for 10 more years. So in your case, you know, maybe that's not an important question to ask, but yeah, I mean, in general, it's all self-education. I mean, really, at the end of the day, this is a weird industry that, you know, of course you're not taught any of this in school, that's a fact, but I mean, even after, it's all about books and networking and just getting questions answered, meeting new people, listening to podcasts like this. So yeah, identify for you kind of what strategies you like. Do you want to be active? Do you want to be passive? Do you want to be in new development? Do you want to be in, you know, value add B class multifamily? What is it for you and why? And then start studying it. Start finding people that invest in those and start asking them, what's your experience? What's happened here? And what if? I mean, that's the best way to educate yourself.
Mm-hmm. And I think to carry on that point is there's no such thing as a stupid question, because there's so many different aspects and avenues to go down. So like you said, if you're thinking of active or passive, ask both sides of the coin to make sure you understand what to expect on both sides so that you can make an educated decision going forward.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree.
It's just like interviewing anyone else, right? And one of the best lessons that I learned a while back from a mentor of mine was, when you're interviewing someone, you're not there just to make them feel good, right? You're there to get to the core of who they are and make sure it's the right fit for you. And when you're investing as an LP, you want to have those tough conversations with the sponsors, and don't be scared of pressing them on their track record or what their how long their team's been working together for, what kind of deals they found, what kind of challenges they're currently facing, things like that, right? What has been some of the more challenging experiences they've ran into? These are important questions, and don't feel, you know, on those calls, if you're going into a business relationship together, don't feel like you just have to keep it completely on the friendly side just to make each other feel good. You obviously want to build rapport and get connected, but if a sponsor is scared to go down those or gets upset with you for asking tough questions, then that's probably an issue in itself, because you're going to be in this for a long time. You're going to run into challenges together, and you want to make sure you have open lines of communication and a transparent team behind you.
Most definitely. Yeah. And don't forget too, that whatever question you have, they've probably already been asked that question, right?
Right.
So don't feel bad about it.
Totally.
And you'd rather have the tough questions on the front end than the back end when money's in play and stakes are at hand. So
don't forget. Yeah. As a limited partner, these are illiquid investments. So depending on the business plan, might be 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. So like you said, it's a long-term commitment. So definitely, you know, take, you know, however long it takes you, you know, take a week or so and just, you know, pencil down every question you have, sleep on them, you know, mm-hmm. If you come up with more, write more down, you know, but get them all out before you make the investment, for sure.
And to your point before, often beauty's in the eye of the beholder, and, you know, same thing goes for the risk that you see in an investment, but would love to hear for you personally, what are some of the challenges that you've seen from different investments you've made? What are things that you typically will stay away from knowing what you know moving forward?
Yeah, good question. And a lot of this is just, you know, over time, right? I've done numerous deals, and so I've got to see, you know, a lot of different things. One thing I really look for today is conservative underwriting, right? I get shown, I don't know, maybe two deals a day or, you know, whatever it is. I don't know the exact number, but I see a lot of aggressive underwriting, like to your point with IRRs, right? Well, this deal is going to have a 20% IRR to it, you know, or we're going to double your money in 4 or 5 years, or we're going to raise rents 300 a month in the first 12 months, you know, whatever it may be. And in some cases, these things are definitely possible, but I definitely look for, you know, a more conservative approach to that future rent growth, you know, incrementally raising rents, maybe 25 a door here and there, you know, as you go along the business plan, whatever it may be. The other thing is what kind of debt structure, you know, speaking to recession and things like that. The last thing you want is to be caught, you know, in the middle of a downturn where you're forced to sell or hand it back to the bank, or the equity's gone and you thought it was there. So I look for groups that are putting, just as an example, it doesn't have to be this, but say on a value add deal, maybe a 10-year debt structure on a 5-year business plan. Mm-hmm. You know, it gives you that 5-year buffer to figure it out, you know, according to the what ifs. And really at the end of the day, I guess what I would say is it's about the team. It's really so much about the team, and it's about not just track record and experience and things like that, but how well do you align in their philosophy? And do you feel comfortable with that? Because at the end of the day, you know, you're giving a person, you're giving some people, you know, $50,000, $100,000, and saying, I trust you to make the right decision for me for the next 5-10 years. That's a big commitment. So it's really about trusting that group and those individuals.
Yeah, I think aligning with the philosophy first is the key way, because you might have the 3 to 5 year window. So other people have the long-term hold. So I think aligning with that philosophy, and then the underwriting comes in and makes sense. And like you said, building the trust and going forward with it. I think those are phenomenal points.
Mm-hmm. Yep, for sure.
Now you are, I think the point about the bridge debt makes a lot of sense. There are a lot of people out there using bridge. There's a lot of talk that interest rates are going to stay low for some time. I would say what we often think about with bridge debt is just seeing how conservative are they being with the bridge debt, because you can get overly aggressive, and you also want to ensure that you have some kind of an exit plan in place. So I think it's always a balance, right? Because right now, if people are using a bridge debt just to make a deal work, then that might be a little bit risky, but yeah. Some deals require it, right? If it's a 70% occupied building, it's going to require it. So you have, right. You have to figure out what that is. So what are some of the questions that someone should ask when they're seeing more of a heavy opportunistic value added. You've probably been in this. A lot of our value adds are lighter value add. Occasionally, you know, when we really see the opportunity, we know the market well, we'll do something a little bit heavier. But I think those are the ones that people should really know how to look deeper into. So what are some of the questions that you'd ask in those situations?
Yeah, that's a great point. So those really are the two metrics. So here you have a team with X amount of experience, track record, connections, whatever. And then over here you have the deal. So you're matching up the deal. What is that really going to take? What's it going to require? Are you doing a full gut rehab and you're going to rip dry roll out, you know, all the way down to the studs and start over and then try to occupy something from zero to 100? Is it that crazy of a business plan? Or is it just slapping some paint on it and putting some new appliances in place and raising rents because they were already under the market value? So depending, right? So you're taking the experience level of in the track record. Have you done this before? How many times? What were the results? And then how heavy of a lift is it? So it's really about balancing those two items. So a brand new group doing their first deal today, and it's a huge, heavy lift. Maybe I'm going to pass on that one, you know, yeah. Or a group with a light deal, you know, like I said, paint and appliances that's done this 10 times. Okay. You know, I feel a lot more comfortable with that. But again, back to your point, I mean, it's just asking these questions, right? Oh, I see that you're putting some bridge debt on this. You know, why is that? You know, or how do you see that unfolding if this were to happen? Or, you know, it's just asking the questions that are concerns to you as an investor.
Yeah, my takeaway is that it's not binary, right? It's not, never will do opportunistic deals that require bridge debt. It's not, you know, I'll only do light value adds. It really largely depends on the entire story. Just like anything else, when you're buying a deal, you have to really take a 360 degree approach to it. You have to learn what is this team's experience, because maybe they're masters at the heavy lift value add stuff and they have timing, and that gives them an edge in the market that gives them better returns. Maybe, like you said, if they're a newer group, maybe you don't want to take the risk because maybe the contractor they hire for the first time doesn't work out and they have to spend another 3 to 6 months hiring new contractors and going through that whole process and adding up additional costs, right? So you really have to understand the full story. And I think the other big takeaway is that it's not just about the number return, because the return could come in a few points higher, a few points lower, right? You really want to watch out for the massive swings, I think, right? And you want to know what the story is, because there are deals that can be a massive swing upwards that turn out to be, you know, that look good in the first place. But when you really know the story is well enough, you believe it could be even better if things work out to plan. And then there are deals that could be detrimental, you know, if it doesn't go out to plan. So you want to know that going into the deal, that you feel comfortable with.
Yep. And again, back to, you know, knowing yourself and taking some time to kind of self-reflect and, you know, what types of strategies fit best with you. Maybe you love the idea of those heavy value adds, you know, it's like a little more risk, but a little more, you know, potential higher return. And that sets well for a lot of people. And others may, you know, I just want to ride this out, get just the minimum, you know, cash flow. If the equity's there, that's cool. If it's not, that's fine. You know, I just want to be conservative, you know, because I believe whatever, you know, we're going into a downturn. So it's about knowing yourself.
Travis, I have a question. Is when you hear the business plan on the narrative side, is there anything you do to kind of vet the pro formas to see, all right, you're doing X, you say you're doing X, but your pro forma says Y? Is there anything you do to kind of vet the narrative with the pro formas?
Other than just a Q&A, I usually do just a one-on-one Q&A with every single deal that comes my way. So I never just take something at face value. Like I get emailed a deal and then I just say, yep, I'm going to do that one. It's always about picking it apart and saying, well, that's interesting debt structure. And that's an interesting, why is there no cash flow in year one? You know, like, and just writing down all those questions and just figuring that stuff out. And, you know, so long as, you know, there's a good answer to all this, that's fine. You know, especially if I've worked with the group before, I already know them and trust them and stuff. It's just really about self-knowledge and understanding, you know, like you said, the risks, what I'm getting into and why.
So. Trust but verify.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Love that.
So the market has clearly changed a lot since you first entered as a passive investor, right? And it's been moving quickly. We're seeing it's a little bit more difficult. I think right now you have to be a little bit more savvy to find a good deal and execute on the business plan than I think there was a little bit more margin for error a few years back, and you know, it was more obtainable to achieve higher returns for many groups, even groups that were completely new. Now, what are you seeing as a passive investor for the deal flow? Is there anything that you're watching out for or that you're not a big fan of in today's market? Because there's always the talk that people in the market as it gets tighter are going to do more to try to make the deal still like it look like it's hitting this massive target return, but it could be the way that it's sliced up. It could be the way that you know, it's being presented. It could be the assumptions behind it.
Yeah, great points. Totally agree with you. And definitely a slowdown in deal flow for sure. Although it's kind of funny because in the beginning I wasn't being sent a lot of deals and now I am. So it's kind of, it's more disguised for me actually seeing more deals today, but that's because I know a lot more groups. Okay. One thing that I'm seeing that I'm not a fan of is a lot of groups doing their very first deal. I think since 2015, a big thing that's changed is all of a sudden everyone's in the syndication space. Everyone's in the value add space. There's a lot of competition. And like you said, a lot of the deals are going to more experienced groups that, you know, can prove to brokers, you know, that we've closed A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and other groups are trying to execute their first deal. That's also where I'm seeing a lot of the aggressive underwriting as well. From those same groups. Like you said, trying to make the numbers work. It's like, you know, 10 other people passed on this. We somehow got it. Now we got to sort of fudge these numbers. Not like in a fraudulent way, but fudge them in a way of like, yeah, you know, I think we're going to get 10% rent growth when maybe it's going to be 1%, you know, some extremes. So you got to know what to look out for. If you're brand new, reach out to folks that have been doing this for a while, you know, ask for a hand. Also, to our point, you know, third, fourth time mentioning it, but ask these questions, you know, to the syndicate group themselves. But, but yeah, so me personally and my philosophy, I'm not as focused on the equity side in general. I've always been just a cash flow focused investor. And, you know, to be honest with you, I'm totally okay if every deal I'm in today never has equity and it's only the cash flow because that's my income. And, you know, that's what is going to get you and I and everyone else to, you know, your financial freedom and to your retirement and to your goals is going to be the cash flow. So.
I love it. Well, that leads me to what I was going to ask you about, the pro tip of the day. So every show we like to leave our listeners with some kind of a pro tip that they can walk away with to make a big impact. And in your case, it's really a two-sided question. Number one, as a past investor, what would you look for to vet a family friend sponsor or someone that's early or brand new to the business on one of their first deals? And then also on the active side, how can a new sponsor, someone that is on their first deal, help better persuade experienced passive investors that to take a chance with them?
Okay, gotcha. Let's start with the first one. I would say this, and this is something I wish I would have done. I was feeling like I was graduating from single family to multifamily and that, you know, I was kind of a big shot, you know, like I made it to the big leagues, you know, like I had way too much of an ego issue to the point that I thought I can vet a deal. I can figure these numbers out. I can do this on my own. I don't need anybody's help. I know what I'm looking, you know, I was trying to be, you know, the smartest guy in the room. I wish what I would have done is taken these pro formas to 3, 4, 5 people in my network that do syndication investing. I said, what do you think? You know, anything stand out to you? What are your thoughts? Would you do this deal? You know, and I wish that I would have got more of a collaborative effort because probably I would have been told to pass on a couple of those in the beginning. You know, like I said, you don't know what you don't know. To your second question, let's go over that one more time just to make sure
I love that answer, by the way. I think I always encourage everyone, you don't, like you said, there's no bad questions to ask, right? And don't ever feel like you can't go up to someone else in the business and ask them for feedback on something before you put your hard-earned money into play, because we can spot things quickly, right? Guys that are looking at deals like us all day, we can, 30 seconds of looking at the pro forma versus the T12, we're gonna be able to pick it apart and tell you this looks pretty good, this doesn't, right? And very, very quickly. So that was just feedback on that. But so the second question, it is for the active investors. They're excited. They have their first deal under contract. Now it's time to raise money. And they're going out to experienced investors or family and friends to work on raising the money. how do they best present themselves? What if I was a brand new investor and I had a deal on the line, what could I do to better incentivize you or better convince you to invest alongside us?
Okay, got it. Be completely truthful and transparent up front. There was one deal I did with a group that was new, and here's what they told me as their little sales pitch. They said, we have 15 years experience. That's all they said. Well, it turns out that was like fix and flip experience. So they actually had no experience in syndications, right? So it's a little misleading. And at, you know, like you said, it's a relationship, right? So now here I am locked in with my money tied up later. And it's like, oh crap. You know, I just gambled on their very first deal and I didn't even know it. So just be transparent. Hey, look, it's our first deal. You know, we're new, but here's the thing. And I would try to have, if possible, someone on your team with the experience, even if they're like a consultant, even if they're just a mentor, right? At least you're going to have that to say, we've got someone here, you know, helping us out, looking over their shoulder, you know, looking at all the numbers, verifying things are correct, our assumptions are right, you know, stuff like that. I think that goes a long way. You know, I mean, if someone had, you know, some mogul above them, you know, you Warren Buffett's on our team, he's going to tell us yay or nay. You know, I feel a lot more comfortable with that than just someone out there telling me which penny stocks to pick. So, yeah, try to put someone on your team with experience, even if you yourself don't have it.
Like you said, it's a relationship business and we're very transparent. A lot of people are very transparent and willing to help. So making sure that person's on your side when active investing as well. But Travis, what is the best way our listeners can reach out to you if they have any passive investing or even active investing questions?
Yeah, sure. So I'm part of the Ashcroft Capital team. You can find me at ashcroftcapital.com or travis@ashcroftcapital.com. I also have a passive investor resource, just a free booklet. It goes over a lot of things we just discussed, how to vet sponsors, how to vet different markets, you know, different deals, things like that. So that's ashcroftcapital.com/passive investor. You can download that for free.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Travis, so much for being on the show and providing our listeners so much value on how you became active to passive and what to look for in a passive deal. Definitely a ton of value and appreciate your time.
And guys, last message to walk away with is that always have an abundance mindset. Realize, I think people oftentimes think that sponsors are competing for passive investors and passive investors shouldn't show that they're working with other sponsors and things like that. We're all in this together. There's more than enough deal flow to go around. There's more than enough investments to make. And I think always having an abundance mindset and realizing that it's a collaborative effort. We want the other good sponsors to be the ones that prevail. We want to make sure that sponsors that are presenting things that don't align with what the market, you know, is truly going to want to see. We want that stuff to get feedback, right? So anything we can do at any point to help, you know, we always want to stress that we'd love to get questions. I know with many investors, I've had them send us, you know, deals that we've been able to look at and give them some kind of you know, feedback to beforehand. So just having an abundance mindset. But there you have it, another episode of the RAND CRE show. Thanks for everyone joining us listening. Appreciate you jumping on the show here, Travis. For our listeners, if you have any questions or things you'd like to see more of, shoot us an email, info@randcre.com. Make sure to leave us a rating, review, and comment, and we will see you next week.
All right, Dylan, Mike, thank you.
Thanks so much.